This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. Listen to us on KPFK, KPFA, and other Pacifica affiliates, and watch us on Free Speech TV, Monday through Friday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern. Why did Donald Trump win the election on November 8th? Attempts to answer that question have consumed so many pundits and media commentators. Surprisingly, among the reasons being bandied about by people like Bill Maher is the idea that diversity and multiculturalism might have been to blame. In other words, according to my guest Adam Johnson, lashing out at identity politics, pundits blame Trump on those most vulnerable to Trump. That's the title of Johnson's new piece for the media watchdog group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. Adam Johnson is a contributing analyst for Fair.org. He also writes for The Nation and Alternet. Welcome to the program, Adam.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So first, in terms of the kinds of comments that we heard, I didn't honestly notice a pattern until you pointed it out, simply because there have been so many questions and so much sort of soul searching and how did we go wrong, where did we go wrong? So I really appreciate that you were able to draw out some of these threads. Bill Maher, of course, long noted for being very liberal on certain issues, but also being intensely Islamophobic. Where does he fall? What was it that he said that troubled you in the wake of the election?
Well, I mean, look, Bill Maher, a right winger who likes to smoke weed and likes gay marriage. Here's the common thread with him and all the other pundits who blame political correctness for Trump, which is that they hated political correctness before Trump. They hated political correctness during the election. And they would have hated it after the election, regardless of who had won. So they are kind of jamming in this grief they have, this ideological beef, into this narrow way that I think is pretty lazy and pretty disingenuous. And I think in a lot of ways that I argue it provides ideological cover for very far right, far right arguments. And I think, frankly, white supremacist arguments.
So among the things that Bill Maher said was that the Democrats were too soft on Muslims. Every time there was a terrorist attack, they wanted to make sure Muslims were not being targeted. That's arguable under President Obama. But still, that was his, you know, he's sort of claiming that that might be a reason why people went for Trump.
Right. And he doesn't have any evidence of this. This is the thing. Like, there isn't any actual empirical basis for any of this. It's sort of just an assumption. And I know that sometimes media criticism and things like elections and how the public receives them are not a perfect science. I understand that. But there is absolutely no justification to believe that other than the fact that he himself believes it. And so what you soon realize is that this white working class demographic, which Clinton did do badly on, I think for economic reasons, not for a lot of these cultural reasons, but that they become a kind of stand-in for the pundit's own grievance. So Bill Maher says, oh, the white working class is tired of being told to check their privilege and tired of being told that they're mansplaining. And it's clear that he's talking not about the white working class, but he's talking about himself. This is his own grievance. This is his own sense of victimization. Here's a guy that is a multimillionaire who has a national show that is, unfortunately, is a very zeitgeist-creating kind of show on a major cable network. And he's constantly talking about how he's being silenced. So there's this persecution complex among many of the others as well, right? David Brooks, George Will, these are people that have hated political correctness for decades, and they'll continue to hate it. And they, I think, are importing their own personal experiences as white men of being, I guess, silenced into this debate in a way that I think is pretty disingenuous and I think ultimately harmful.
And in fact, we should remember that Bill Maher's original show was politically incorrect, right? That was literally the title of his original show. And some of the things that Trump said during his campaign that a lot of people on the right, conservatives who were tired of having to hide their racism, kept quoting. I almost wonder if rather than comparing Trump to the standard right-wing evangelical Christian voter, which he's not, but he's been, supported by, he is much closer to the likes of people like Bill Maher, politically speaking.
Well, I mean, there's an expression among certain circles that the person who traffics most in identity politics is Donald Trump. He traffics in white identity politics. And what does that mean? It means a kind of the sense that the white person or the white man is under siege by these liberal forces, that they cuddle, you know, Muslims, and they everybody wants their own gender pronoun. There's the sense that the, I guess, the white supremacist order, to put it in stark terms, is somehow being undermined, or it's kind of out of control, and that Donald Trump provides a kind of corrective to that. Now, this has been an underlying current in right wing, and I think certain centers of nominally liberal discourse for several years. There's a small part of it that stems, I think, from somewhat of a legitimate concern that some of the political correctness language is maybe a bit too boutique or a bit too persnickety. But that's not, I think that's amplified 10x, 1000x into this kind of worldview that somehow pluralism and multiculturalism and diversity are eroding the fabric of society. There's a kind of moral panic to it. And I think that to blame that on the election is to sort of miss many points. The first of which being is that many Republicans and many conservatives don't need an excuse to vote for a Republican. The extent to which there was an exodus of the white working class from the Democratic column to the Republican column, which there was, I think the swing was about 16%. That was largely attributed to economic reasons, and not to the idea of gender bathrooms. I think these things are a little bit cosmetic, and I think they get blown out of proportion. And those who have beef with quote-unquote political correctness, which is usually just having beef with minorities, and in Marr's case, it's him having beef with a specific ethnicity and a specific religion, that they projected that onto these election results to kind of carry their own ideological baggage. And I don't think they do a really good job connecting the dots.
But they have a lot of influence. So in addition to Bill Maher, let's go through some of the others that you laid out in your article on fair.org. Vox, whose editor-in-chief is another nominally liberal person, Ezra Klein, ran an interview with John Haidt, a noted diversity skeptic, you called him. This is what John Haidt said in the interview. Multiculturalism and diversity have many benefits, including creativity and economic dynamism, but they also have major drawbacks, which is that they generally reduce social capital and trust, and they amplify tribal tendencies. Honestly, I couldn't believe that somebody who claims to be a smart person would say such a thing as this. What does this mean?
Well, as I noted on Twitter, it's one qualifier away from a Stormfront comment. It is the underlying argument of white supremacy, right? That the blacks have the blacks and the Asians have the Asians, and we have white people. That's the argument of Richard Spencer of the alt-right, of neo-Nazis. And I'm not calling John Haidt a neo-Nazi. Of course not. I'm not saying that at all. But he is definitely teetering on an argument that one needs to be very careful about. And there are branches of sociology and anthropology that discuss multiculturalism as something that can be eroding. I think the science is not really in on that. I think a lot of that is circumstantial. But they're starting to tease with, I think, some threads that are, if not by intent, by effect, white supremacist. And I sort of see a parallel in the late 2000s or the mid 2000s when liberals started flirting with race science. If you remember this phase, in Slate, they would talk about whether or not, you know, different IQs along race. There's a kind of like, there's a sort of contrarianism that goes into a lot of the liberal clickbait that goes to the other, that kind of goes over the edge into like outright white supremacist apologia. And I thought that comment in particular was pretty dubious and should have been pushed back by the interviewer, but it wasn't. And again, it plays into this idea that somehow there is this moral panic, that there's this eroding force of diversity, and that, you know, gender pronouns are somehow, you know, undermining the fabric of our society. And what that does is it gets the real centers of power off the hook. And this is my main problem with this. Aside from all the kind of ideological collateral damage in terms of white supremacy, that it gets the Clinton campaign off the hook. It gets white racism off the hook. It gets, most importantly, it gets capitalism off the hook, right? It gets neoliberal capitalism that has wreaked havoc on these communities in the Rust Belt. It gets them off the hook. And so what you see post-election is that the expression goes, and I'll use a euphemism, downhill. That those being blamed.
I'm sorry.
Are,
say that again. Say that again, Adam. The expression goes.
That crap rolls downhill. I apologize. That the most vulnerable and the easiest targets post-election are being blamed, and now you see this mythical political correctness mob being blamed in a way that is, I think, pretty disingenuous and is really helping to provide cover for some very right-wing arguments, some very sort of cynical ideas about what it means to change America, what it means to have increasing minority populations, what it means to be more open to LGBT and LGBTQ. And now we're somehow blaming these people for it. I think there's something very perverse about that.
And so let's just kind of come out and say it. When these writers say multiculturalism, a multi-ethnic society, diversity, what they're basically saying is there's too many people of color in the U.S. You know, I mean, and that, you know, that non-white community, of course, includes the descendants of enslaved Africans. It includes Native Americans. It includes Mexicans who were already here before the border crossed them. And it includes new immigrants. And you have people like Steve Bannon, who is the editor-in-chief of Breitbart, who's now going to be the chief strategist of Trump, having made a comment in the past about there being too many Asian CEOs in Silicon Valley, even though, of course, they're a very small minority. So there's just too many brown people, basically, in the U.S., according to these folks.
Bannon made a similar argument in that the Asian CEOs were eroding the cultural fabric of Silicon Valley, which is not too much different than Haidt's argument. Again, we're really, really, really playing with live ammunition here, ideologically. And David Brooks has been trafficking this for a long time. David Brooks writes expressly white supremacist articles often. And in this one in particular, and I don't know if you have the article in front of you, but he basically says that those fighting racism have become as bad. And he doesn't quite say that, but he says they've almost become as bad as the racists themselves because they've raised money and targeted minority groups. Well, it's like, yeah, of course minorities are going to stick together to fight racists. Like that's a reaction to a system. That's not its own system per se. So it's pretty toxic stuff. It's a lot of victim blaming. It's a lot of projection on the part of these, I think, largely white male pundits. And I hate to do the whole like I'm a woke white guy routine. I'm not doing that. But like you can kind of see that there's a kind of white grievance that manifests itself. And it can take liberal form. It can take a kind of nominally left form, too.
Right, because some of these are folks who wish Clinton would have won, and they're saying that the Democrats appealing to communities of color and uplifting multiculturalism and diversity has lost them the election. They're blaming, as you point out in the title of your article, they're blaming the most vulnerable people. In fact, the people who most, if you look at, for example, the black vote, black women were among the most ardent voters of Clinton. They're blaming them for Clinton's loss.
Well, so here's the underlying problem. I think what people are trying to get at is that Clinton did not run an adequately populist campaign economically, which is true. It is an argument I've been trumpeting for a year. But here's the thing. Clinton is a neoliberal centrist. She was always a neoliberal centrist. She'll die a neoliberal centrist. The fact that she reached out to communities of color or said Black Lives Matter or made messages targeting LGBTQ, that doesn't mean she was ever going to be Bernie Sanders economically. So there's an argument that she went too far center economically, that lost some of these quote unquote working class voters. But that would have happened with or without diversity or with or without identity politics. That identity politics has become this kind of a sin eater, right? This kind of scapegoat, this thing that we blame everything on. If your issue is economics, which I think is a good issue, because I do think material forces affect these voting turnouts, I think they're far more motivated by a lack of a reason to vote for Clinton, e.g. universal health care, free college, more of the sort of bolder, more socialist plans than they are people's gender pronoun preference. I think that there's a failure that instead of analyzing the fundamental issues in the Democratic Party vis-a-vis the failure of working class people of all races, by the way, and there was a lower African American turnout in a lot of major cities, and I think the economic issue had a lot to do with that. Instead of existentially questioning that, we just sort of blame this abstract concept of political correctness. Because again, it gets everyone in power off the hook. And I think any argument that gets people in power off the hook should be skeptical of by definition.
Well, Adam, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. We'll post a link to your article from our website so that people can get all of the citations that you made your argument with. I want to thank you so much.
Thank you.
My guest is Adam Johnson. He is a contributing analyst for Fair.org. He also writes for The Nation and Alternet. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can find our interviews online at risingupwithsonali.com and also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes.